Well, let's take out our Bibles this morning and turn to the second book of the Bible, the book of Exodus. We're going to be hearing the call to Exodus for a number of weeks and months. So I'm hoping you have a Bible somewhere close to you, accessible, maybe on your phone, maybe on your tablet. There are also just physical, actual books in the back there, Bibles, so you can grab one for yourself or grab one for your neighbor. The book of Exodus, fairly easy to find, at least for me, second book of the Bible. So Genesis, then Exodus chapter 1. And before we begin this morning, I do want to say a word of thanks to you as a church community. There are moments where I hear about things going on in our church community. I don't hear about all of them, but I hear about ways that we extend what I would call pastoral care or care in the name of Jesus Christ to one another. I sometimes hear about someone making a meal for someone else, someone going to the home of a member of the church or someone else, cleaning their house, taking someone to an appointment, organizing childcare, just being a listening ear for someone in need, praying with others, praying for others, sending a card, the list goes on. And I just want to say thank you for being a people that is seeking to love each other, care for one another in very practical ways. As we know from the Bible, we can't just say, I love you, right? I mean, that's not wrong to say, but if we only ever said, I love you, and we never did anything, we would wonder, do we really love each other? So thank you for those very tangible expressions of the love of Jesus put into action. And even as we evidence love for each other with the scriptures, I want to say, even as we're doing that, may our love for each other more and more, right? So it's there, it's happening, thank God, but more and more may our love for each other increase. This morning we're picking up this sermon series on the book of Exodus. We're calling it Freedom, or we could call it freedom, right? We can just say it kind of religiously, like, oh, freedom, like we typically do in church. Just, you know, not too excited about the realities of God. Or we could say, boy, a whole book in the Bible helping us understand this idea of freedom, or deliverance, or salvation, or liberation, or as God tells Moses to tell Pharaoh, let my people go. And I'm wondering if anyone caught that this morning in one of the songs we sang. This Exodus theme. Anybody catch that this morning? So thankful the worship team led us in that. I don't know if we can get on the screen fast enough, Tom. Maybe not, but it's a third song in the worship set, No Longer Slaves. I've heard the song before. I've sung it before. And then we got toward the end of the song, and it was the actual kind of Exodus theme, a little bit further, a little bit further, a little further. Yeah. Anybody catch that? You split the sea. That's the book of Exodus. So I could walk right through it. My fears were drowned in perfect love. You rescued me so I could, and that's what happens in the book of Exodus. They stand after the crossing of the Red Sea, and they sing, right? So we're looking, I'm thankful, the worship team, but also hopefully in coming weeks, the same kind of themes. Can we hear them in other songs? Maybe we've sung before, but now we hear them afresh because we're really immersing ourselves in this Exodus story. And I'm hoping that as we go through even this morning's message, but also in coming weeks, it's not just a story from the past, but it's a story also in our lives right now. Right? It's where is the Exodus? Where's it happened for us? And where is God calling us into more Exodus? So we're going to read this morning from the book of Exodus, and Bill is ready. So, Exodus chapter 1.
These are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. The descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died. But the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly, increased in numbers, and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. Then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt. "Look," he said to his people, "the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous and, if war breaks out, will join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country." So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for the Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and work them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with harsh labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their harsh labor, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, "When you are helping the Hebrew women during childbirth on the delivery stool, if you see that the baby is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, let her live." The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, "Why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live?" The midwives answered Pharaoh, "Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive." So God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all the people: "Every Hebrew boy that is born must be thrown into the Nile, but let every girl live." This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. Now, if someone asked me, because of my extensive knowledge of film and my ability to direct movies and all of my experience with that, if they were asking me to make a movie about the book of Exodus, and I could kind of direct how this movie would be shot, I would like to do the following as I think about the opening verses of the book of Exodus, and maybe you can imagine this in your mind. I would like for someone, some famous musician who has written other musical scores, to write a piece of music for me that would begin the movie. It would be a black screen, and you would hear music that would be peaceful kind of music. That's how Exodus would begin for me. It would be a kind of music that would make you think about all the good things in life. It would make you think, if your home was a good home, it would make you think about home. It's the kind of music as you're watching the screen. First of all, it's black. There's nothing there. It would put you at ease. It's the kind of music that if you heard it, you would say, "Everything's fine. Everything's good. All is well." And then as the camera starts to show you something on the screen, you would see the land of Egypt. And as the camera got closer and closer, kind of going over the land of Egypt, we would fly over Cairo. We would see the pyramids of Giza there, which I have to remind myself, those pyramids were there before the Israelites got to Egypt, right? The pyramids about 2500 BC, and people of Israel are going to Egypt around 1800 BC with Joseph and the rest. I'm always amazed. The same pyramids we see, the people of Israel saw. So as we're flying over Egypt and we're moving toward the land of Goshen in the northern part of Egypt, we would see the pyramids, and then we would see rivers and fields and animals and dwellings. And if you remember the first few verses that Bill read for us, what else would you see? We see rivers and fields and dwellings, and we see lots and lots of people. Yeah, Israelites. Lots and lots of people, young and old, boys and girls, men and women. And the kind of atmosphere I'd want to give as someone heard the music and visualized the beginning of this movie, again, is all is good, all is well. The people are flourishing, the land is flourishing. The blessing of God is on the people and the land and the animals. And if at all possible, as people watch that opening scene of this movie, I would want them to maybe make a connection. I'm hoping they make a connection to the first book of the Bible, the book of Genesis chapter 1, where the same kind of scene is happening. Right? God saying over and over again, he's making the creation. It is good. It is the flourishing and the blessing of God Almighty is on this creation. And I want to make that kind of connection because that's the connection the author of Exodus makes. I'm sure some of you caught that. When we're told in verse 9, the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly. The land was filled with them. Those words and phrases, of course, are connected right to the beginning of the Bible as God blesses humanity and says, be fruitful and multiply and fill the whole earth. That's what's happening. Right? The blessing of God is on the people of Israel, even though they're not in Canaan, they're not in the promised land, they're away from the promised land, away from their inheritance, away from their home, but the blessing of God is still on them so abundantly that even in Egypt, they are flourishing and blessing, and the blessing of God from the early part of the Bible is upon them. Egypt is almost a kind of Garden of Eden. At least for a while. And if I were still directing the movie, and people said, oh, that's pretty good, let's keep going, I would want suddenly the music to change, right? We've heard this peaceful, wonderful, kind of flourishing music, and then I'd want the music to change because something changes in the story. Right? Someone changes in the text. We're told in verse 8, there arose a Pharaoh who did not know Joseph. For some reason, he's not connected with what happened in the previous book of the Bible, what God did through Joseph to rescue the land and the people of Egypt. He's not connected with the history of God's saving work. Either intentionally or unintentionally, he doesn't know what's happened before. And so, like all powerful kings of that time, and anyone in that area of the world who was a king or a pharaoh, he is the man, right? He is the man in Egypt. He is the big man on campus. He's in charge. He calls the shots. He's the absolute ruler. He has no rivals. This pharaoh who arises would be, we are told, the only one in Egypt of whom people would say, he's made the image of God. He has a connection to God that nobody else in Egypt has. He's really, really special. Maybe we'll even call him like a son of God, but nobody else has that, but he does. And his word can bring life to you, and his word can bring death to you. And although he has all this power, and maybe because he has all this power, this Pharaoh is not kind. He's not merciful. He's not gracious. He is a kind of, he's a kind of Darth Vader. Or maybe better, at least for 2019, he's a kind of Thanos from the recent Avenger movies. Now, maybe a little snickering. This guy's not like Thanos, is he? Well, of course he is, because Thanos means what? The name Thanos means, who said that? Oh yeah, thank you, death. So if you watch the Avenger movies, or you've heard about them, what an appropriate name for Thanos, who's trying to kill half of the universe, right? He is death incarnate. And that's also this Pharaoh. He is the king of death. And characters like Darth Vader and Thanos and this Pharaoh and every wicked, evil leader throughout human history are always characterized by fear. This is the amazing thing about people in power. And I think even in our day, we have certain leaders in certain countries who look so powerful, look so strong, call all the shots, but I guarantee in the heart of each of those leaders is a lot of fear. Because when you have a lot of power, you're always afraid someone's going to take your power. Someone's scheming against me, so I'll fire you and you and you. And then I'll fire you and you and you. And maybe I'll get rid of you. And that's certainly what Pharaoh does. For some reason, these people are a little bit different than the Egyptians. I'm afraid of them. I see the blessing of God on them, but I'm afraid of them. So in my fear, I'm going to start scheming against them. I will enslave them. That doesn't work. So now I'm going to kill them. But I can't kill them. So I'll have the midwives do my dirty work. But these midwives fear God, so now I have to just all out kill them, murder them. I believe a kind of genocide, throw all those Hebrew boys into the Nile River. That's the kind of Pharaoh we're dealing with. And in the broader story of the Bible, who is Pharaoh like? Sorry, I hear some. Yeah, he's like Satan, but in this, yeah, very good. But in the story of the Bible, let's say from the book of Genesis, who is Pharaoh like? Yeah, okay, but I'm going to pick up the snake here. So for me, he's like the snake in the Garden of Eden. And I say that because the author's making connections back to the book of Genesis, back to the opening chapter. All is good, all is well, all is flourishing, and all of a sudden pops up the snake, or pops up Pharaoh. So he's an unexpected character getting in the way of God's blessing. I'm also going to suggest he's like the snake because he says in verse 10, come, let's deal shrewdly. And it's very much like the book of Genesis chapter 3 where the author says the snake was more crafty than any of the wild animals. Shrewdly. Crafty. Evil sometimes is stupid, but it's not always stupid. Oftentimes evil is downright shrewd, crafty, cunning, wily, almost a kind of being very smart with what it's doing. I also think that Pharaoh is like the snake or like the evil one because of what Jesus says in John chapter 10, where he compares himself with what he calls the thief. Right? The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy, which is what the snake does in the Garden of Eden and what Pharaoh is doing in the book of Exodus. He is stealing people's freedom and rights and life. He is killing baby boys and destroying people through brutal slavery and murder. So in just the first few verses of the Exodus story, we have this king, this Pharaoh, this leader, who is very much the snake, the evil one, the thief, the embodiment, I would say, of the curse. And as we think about the opening chapter, and maybe some of you are asking this question, I'm not sure, but I'm assuming some people, if they would read just the first chapter, and they hear about all this evil, all this killing, all this slavery that's happened, I'm sure someone might be asking the question, where's God? Where's God in the midst of all of this evil and slavery and murder? Why doesn't he show up? Why isn't he doing something? Is God somehow behind the eight ball? Is he being surprised with what is going on? Is he keeping up with the events of history? Now, I know we have these two midwives who fear God, and the text says that God blessed them with families of their own because they feared him, but it seems like a very small response from God in the midst of all of this evil going on. Now, maybe the question, where is God, might be unsettling to us. For those of us who know the rest of the story, you might say, well, God's coming. Just got to wait a few chapters. He's coming. But I want to know right now, where is God? And although unsettling, this is a question like other unsettling questions that we should kind of be ready for. I'm thinking about other unsettling questions that the church sometimes faces. Like the questions, why are Christians, and especially Christian leaders, church leaders, why are they such hypocrites? Now that should be, at least for me, a very unsettling question, right? Why are Christians such hypocrites? Why are leaders in the church such hypocrites? And I think, in the past I would have said, what? What? How dare you ask that question of the church, of Christians, of church leaders? I'm offended by that kind. I'm going to dodge that question. But these days, if someone asked me that question, I would say, you're probably right. At least from my understanding of the church, my experience of the church, you are right. And there's some confession that the church needs to do, church leaders need to do, kind of recognize the hypocrisy that goes on. And I'm so thankful that we don't call you to follow church leaders or follow the church, but rather we're always calling people to follow Jesus Christ, in whom there is no hypocrisy. So if you see it in me or in someone else, hopefully we will confess that and we will point you to the one in whom there is no hypocrisy. So this morning's question, where is God in the midst of all the slavery and murder and evil, might be unsettling. But I think it's a question that sometimes people are asking, not just Exodus chapter 1, but also other times in our lives. It's not kind of the nice question that I might want to be asked, right? If I'm, doing a study on Exodus chapter 1, I don't want someone to ask, where's God? I want them to ask, those two names of the midwives, Shiphrah and Puah, why are those names so significant? And then we would go into an extended study about those names, where those names come from, what those names mean, and have some answers. Wouldn't that be great? But I'm realizing those are not always the kind of questions people are asking of the Bible. Sometimes the questions are much more visceral or much more gut level, like, where in the world is God? And I want to answer that question because I think the Bible answers that question. So Exodus, as the author is showing us, is not a new story, right? Exodus is a continuation of the Genesis story. And in the book of Genesis, we actually have God anticipating this time in Egypt. Right? So God is talking to Jacob in Genesis 46. Jacob, his son has gone, been sold into slavery, gone to Egypt. Joseph has. Now the whole family's going to go there. And God says in Genesis 46, verse 3 and 4, fear not to go down to Egypt, for I will be there to make you a great nation. I will go with you. Right? You're going to leave Canaan to go to Egypt, and I'm going to go with you, and then I'm going to bring you back again. So God's not caught off guard with them going to Egypt or settling there. He has a plan for them. And even earlier on in the book of Genesis, we have this time where God is speaking to Abraham in Genesis chapter 15. And he says, know for certain that for 400 years, your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own. They'll be enslaved and mistreated there. I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward, they will come out with great possessions. So as I read through the book of Genesis, anticipating Exodus, I can say that God is not on vacation. Right? God is not taken off guard by the events of Pharaoh and his slavery plan. God saw what was coming, and he foreknew all of this. God foreknew the Israelites in Egypt, 400 years, slavery, and also the Exodus. Now, when I say this morning God foreknew, I'm not suggesting he's a fortune teller. God is not a fortune teller. He doesn't simply just know the future. God knows the future. He sees the future, at least from our perspective as human beings. There's past, present, and future for us. He sees the future. He's working in the present, from our perspective, for the future, but also working in the future at the future's time. So he sees it. He's working, and he's always, always, always working for good. That's what I mean when I say God foreknew, or he saw. He knew what was going to happen. He didn't just see the events. He saw it, had plans for it, around it, and always plans for good. One of the commentaries I'm reading as I'm getting ready for these weekly messages is a commentary by Alec Motyer called The Message of Exodus. It's just going through the book of Exodus, kind of saying some things. And in this commentary, he says this about Exodus chapter 1, experiences without explanations. That's what the first chapter of Exodus is all about. Our only comfort is that God comes to us in the day of darkness and lovingly reassures us that it is all right. It is all planned. It will all be well. So as we think about what's going on with Pharaoh and the slavery and the murders of baby boys, God, seeing this event already hundreds of years before, it's all right, it's all planned, it will all be well somehow. And it's not just Exodus where we get this theme. You know, I think we have it throughout the Bible, but especially in the cross of Jesus Christ. So we're going to celebrate that in a few moments. We are told in different places in the Bible that although a gruesome death, Jesus on the cross, although a bloody death, although Jesus on an execution cross, crucified like a criminal, even though all that is going on, God had a plan. God saw this, he planned it, and he was always planning this event for good. And it's not like sometimes people hear, oh, God planned it. That meant the Father was forcing the Son to do something he didn't want to do, right? That's not what I mean when I say God planned the cross. What I mean is, The Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit planned the cross. Each one part of the plan. Each one willingly part of the plan. A plan to save the world. A plan through the cross of Jesus, long before it happened, and then also in the midst of it, and now looking back at it, a plan through the cross to forgive us all our sins. I think we hear that, especially if you're in church long enough, you hear that, you think, heard it, tell me something new. I am. All the sins of this past week, all the sins of today, all the sins coming up this week, through Jesus Christ, forgiven, washed away, never on your accounts. Now I, and us who have heard that so many times, there should be some kind of response, at least in our hearts. Like, whoa, you mean every sin, every blemish, every wrong thought, deed and action, and word? A plan to forgive every sin. A plan to free us from death and hell and all the evil pharaohs of our lives. A plan to reconcile us to God and to each other. A plan to place us in a new place, a new land. God, from the book of Genesis, knew and had a plan for good regarding the suffering of Joseph in Egypt. He saw that, he knew it, he was working in that to bring good. God knew and had a plan for the good regarding the suffering of his people in Egypt in the book of Exodus. God knew beforehand had a plan for the suffering of Jesus on the cross. God knew long beforehand had a plan for the suffering of the church in the book of Acts and in the early chapters, the early centuries of church history. And because of all of that, I can say with confidence God knew long beforehand and had a plan for good regarding our suffering, regarding your suffering. It is all right, it is all planned, and it will all be well. Whatever evil one or Pharaoh or Thanos you are under, it is all right, it is all planned, and it will all be well. And I don't want to say that glibly this morning. I don't want to say that piously. I'm hoping that there are others of us this morning who could say something like that. Looking back or in our present moments, something's happening. Relationships, finances, sometimes I wrote down here this morning, I wrote down personality. You know, even in the personality God has given us, we might wonder, why did he make me like this? It is all right. It is all planned. It will all be well. And even I want to say to those, and I was a little fearful the other day when I was listening to some young people talk about these marches. They kind of put some fear into me. I want to say, even in response to all the marches and all the discussion about the climates, I believe I can say it is all right. It is all planned. It will all be well. Which doesn't mean we just say, well, who cares? Right? God didn't say, who cares about my people in Egypt in slavery? He sent the rescuer. But in the midst of it all, there's a rock bottom hope in what God is doing in our lives. And I'm so thankful we have that in the Scriptures. I'm so thankful we can also have that this morning as we celebrate this communion.